Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, on what looks to be a spectacular spring day here in Park City. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
And while the present is fantastic, we're going to start by peering into the future with author Adam Becker. He's going to discuss his new book, More Everything Forever.
And then we'll chat with Guy Peterson, owner of Stock Exchange, a purveyor of all kinds of meat down in Camas. And we'll finish our hour by speaking with Claude Bethea of Solux Homes about how AI can help in home building. All this and more on Mountain Money.
The richest men in the world not only dominate the world of international commerce, they increasingly have sought to push forward visions of a future powered by fantastical technology. So what are the real visions of the future being promoted by people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos? Are these visions likely to materialize? And should we want them to? Author Adam Becker takes a deep look into this world in his new book, More Everything Forever: AI Overlords, Space Empires, and Silicon Valley's Crusade to Control Humanity. We're lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Adam, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So tell us why you decided to write this book and how long it took you to do the research.
Oh, I mean, it took me about 3 or 4 years to write the book, but I was actually researching these people and the communities that I talk about in the book for years before that. So, you know, it's been a lengthy and detailed process, which was needed because the conclusions that I came to were pretty shocking.
And one of the great things about this book is the way you sort of end up going on a tour through a bunch of communities that most of us have never heard of, right? But are filled with people who spend all kinds of intellectual time and energy forecasting about the future with very divergent views. You describe a vision of the future that is dominated by technologies that seem right out of science fiction. Before we sort of start our little bit of a tour into what some of these philosophers and scientists are thinking, can you describe what AGI is?
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's a difficult question because part of the problem that I outline in the book is that nobody actually has a very clear definition of what AGI is. But AGI is an acronym. It stands for Artificial General Intelligence. And the idea is that AGI is sort of the kind of AI you see in science fiction. That might actually be the best definition. It's not the AI we have now. It's like Commander Data from Star Trek or something like that.
Or HAL from 2001. HAL from 2001.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, or you know, any of these robots or AIs from science fiction that can, you know, just seem to be like on the same level as humans or beyond that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, does ChatGPT really manifest indications of actual intelligence?
No. No.
Boy, as an old lawyer, that felt like a deposition answer. Can you help us a little
can
bit?
Can you expand on that?
Yeah, can you expand on that a little bit? I thought your discussion of it was really interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks, yeah. I can't tell you how nice it is to talk with you guys who actually read the book. So many interviews, people don't read it. ChatGPT is, you know, it appears intelligent, but it's not. It's just predicting the next word. The only thing that ChatGPT knows how to do is to predict the next word so that it comes out similar to the large amount of text that it was trained on. And so basically it speaks with the smeared out averaged voice of humanity, of the internet. But it doesn't have any conception of anything beyond text. It doesn't understand anything. It just has probabilities of what the best next word or next few sentences will be given what it's already said.
Gotcha. I understand that it also wants to just please the user.
Well, yeah, that too. But also it doesn't want anything, right? Like this is part of the problem. We're used to anything that can produce language being a human and having an intelligence behind it. this is, you know, taking advantage of that bias that we have. There is no intelligence at work behind ChatGPT, but we're inclined to attribute intelligence to it because that's just the way that humans look at the world.
That's perfect. So there are a lot of fascinating characters in the book, some lesser known, some known. Can you share a bit about Ray Kurzweil and his vision for reuniting with his father?
Sure, yeah. I mean, look, I want to be really clear. I have sympathy for Kurzweil, but yeah. Ray Kurzweil is a technologist, an inventor who has legitimately created a lot of, you know, really interesting pieces of technology. But he also has these wild speculations about the future that are based on essentially nothing. He thinks that the rate of technological change and development is accelerating and will get to a point where we, humanity, and our computers essentially have godlike powers of creation and destruction. And he thinks at that point we'll be able to do things like resurrect perfect AI copies of dead people, like his father, who died prematurely, and he misses him very much. And I mean, like I said, I have a lot of sympathy for Kurzweil. That makes a lot of sense. But also, buddy, that's not going to happen. Go to therapy.
and there are a couple of concepts that are flying around in here, one of which is, we talk about Moore's Law, right? We talk about the concept of, you know, a rapid increase in technology, but most, I guess most things come to an asymptotic end at some point and don't grow in exponential growth forever. Kurzweil seems to think to the contrary, that there's really going to be this continued growth.
Yeah. I mean, this is to me one of the most egregiously unscientific things that Kurzweil says, right? The one thing we know is always true about exponential growth is that it ends.
Right.
If you see something growing exponentially, your first thought should be, oh, well, that can't last. And Kurzweil says, oh, yeah, it's growing exponentially, and it's just going to do that forever. I mean, the two ways that exponential growth go in nature are either it sort of, you know, flattens out and saturates, or it leads to a crash.
Right. So we're getting close to a concept that it pervades the book, and that's the concept of singularity. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so that's this idea that Kurzweil and others have promoted, that eventually this exponential growth in technological advancement, a concept, by the way, that they're not very clear about in the first place, but that the exponential growth of technological advancement will lead to this moment where, or period where, human technology changes human civilization so much that we gain these powers of, you know, godlike powers essentially through the development of a super intelligent AGI, that an AI will start improving itself more and more and more and get as smart as humans and become an AGI and then go past that point and become a super intelligent AGI, at which point it will know essentially everything and be able to do essentially anything and become like a god. And there's no reason to believe in any of that.
It's kind of scary.
Yeah, exactly. So AGI, you know, expanding capabilities of AGI. What's the notion of the expanding AGI capabilities as a danger to humanity? That has been a long been a staple of science fiction. Can you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's this idea that when AGI shows up, it will inevitably go through that kind of intelligence explosion. It will improve itself until it's godlike. And then at that point, it will just do whatever it wants. And if what it wants is not the same thing as what humans want, then too bad for us. And it'll disassemble Earth and disassemble humans and use the materials that we're made of for something else.
Yeah, right back to Hal, you know. It won't open the pod bay doors.
And this gets us to the world of, I think it's, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Eliezer Yudkowsky. And this, you have this one chapter about the paperclip golem, which I really thought was a wonderful image.
Yeah. I mean, I can't take credit for it. But Yudkowsky and his followers are really, really worried about this super intelligent AGI showing up and killing us all, essentially all at once. In very short order, they think it's coming soon. Yudkowsky certainly thinks it's coming very soon, or could be coming extremely soon. And again, there's essentially no reason to believe this. The arguments that Yudkowsky and others have put forth to say, oh, AGI is a thing, it's coming soon, it will inevitably lead to this godlike AGI that will try to kill us all, those arguments just fall apart if you look at them. And that's a lot of what I do in the book, is take a close look and just disassemble them. They don't work. But they're really influential in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Even though they don't
work. Just briefly, so our audience can enjoy this, what was the paperclip golem model?
Sorry, yes, I should have said that, absolutely. So the idea is that, you know, you get this AGI, it shows up. It's been, you know, given this task. It was created to do something. Like, say, it was created by a company that produces paperclips, and so the AI was given the goal of produce more paperclips. And in the process of you know, self-improvement that it goes through once it becomes super intelligent, it just tries to find better and better ways to make more paperclips. It keeps wanting to make paperclips. And so it looks at the Earth and says, oh, there's a lot of material there that we could use to make paperclips, but all those pesky humans are going to get in the way and try to stop me from doing that. So I better kill them all and then turn the entire Earth into paperclips, and then Mars and Jupiter and the rest of the solar system and the universe.
And you do point out that this does sort of remind one of the wonderful image of Mickey Mouse and the brooms in The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I can't take credit for that. Yudkowsky makes that same analogy. And it does look like that.
Yeah.
But it falls apart. You know, the magic isn't real. You can't enchant a broomstick like that.
Yeah. Now, you identify a streak of racism associated with the rationalist community. What is HBD, and how widely is it accepted in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So HBD is this pseudo-scientific and racist concept called human biodiversity. It's basically a whitewashed name for the idea that white people are smarter than other races. And that there's some genetic component that proves this. And this is just not true. You know, the genetics and genomics, like the modern sciences of human biology and inheritance, show that not only is there no such, you know, is there no reason to believe that there is anything like that, but also race itself is not a biological thing. It's a purely social construct. So it's not true, and there's no way that it could be true, but it's pretty widely believed, or at least seriously entertained, both among this rationalist community, which, as I said, is very influential in Silicon Valley and the tech industry, and also more widely among, you know, some of the leaders of the tech industry. There's this belief that some kinds of people are just better, and there's no evidence for that, and it's really an odious and disgusting belief.
And that's widespread through Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it's way more widespread than you'd think. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, go ahead.
All right, let's go to space.
Sure.
Again, one of the amusing things about this book is the way we go through these topics. How realistic are the notions of Bezos and Musk and others who talk about a future for humanity colonizing space?
Yeah, no, those ideas pretty much don't work. You know, Musk has been really specific about this, which, you know, as a journalist and as somebody trained as a scientist, it's nice that he's been consistent about this. Musk has said over and over again that he wants to have 1 million people living on Mars by 2050 in a city on Mars, to make sure that they're a backup for humanity that will survive even if some disaster on Earth means the rockets stop coming from Earth. And there are so many things wrong with this idea. It just doesn't work. You know, Mars is a horrible place to live. The radiation levels are too high. The gravity is too low. There's no air. And the dirt is made of poison. And as for disasters, you know, Musk talks about things like global warming or an asteroid strike or nuclear war. None of those things could make Earth less habitable than Mars. Mars is awful. And also, Mars gets more asteroid strikes than Earth. It's closer to the asteroid belt. You know, it's a horrible place. Bezos wants to make thousands or tens of thousands of giant cylindrical space stations that will each have millions of people on them. He has said multiple times that he wants a future where 1 trillion people live in these space stations. That's just not going to happen. We don't know how to build such space stations, and it's not clear that it would be, you know, like it wouldn't be a great place to live even if we could build them. And getting trillions of people up there, it's just not going to happen. And it's all in service of this idea of like endless growth and exploitation and domination. The Earth's a good place. We should stay here.
And you know, if these guys weren't so successful in business, would anybody be paying any attention to this stuff?
No. I mean, nobody would be paying attention to what they're saying. No. I mean, it is true that these ideas about the future didn't originally come from these billionaires. They're not very good at original thought, I think. But, you know, these are ideas about the future that come from science fiction, but they're science fiction. Like, this picture of an inevitable future in space is not a picture that comes from science. It's just something that comes from science fiction. And, like, I love science fiction, but it's not a roadmap to the future.
No, it's a story. It's fiction.
Yeah. And these guys who are remarkable at certain feats of engineering and certain entrepreneurial visions and building giant businesses, how often do they get the underlying science wrong when they step out of their box?
Almost constantly. They are not scientists, and they just don't know the relevant science. You know, Musk has said that there's enough, carbon dioxide locked up in ice on Mars to create an atmosphere for the planet that would allow humans to walk around. That's just not true for lots of different reasons. There's not enough carbon dioxide, and also humans can't deal with an atmosphere of just carbon dioxide. And even if you try to fix that by putting plants on the planet that will turn that into oxygen, we still wouldn't be able to handle it. Even if there was enough oxygen, if the rest of the atmosphere was just carbon dioxide, we would constantly feel like we were choking. It's just basic facts about physics, planetary science, biology, sociology, politics. They do not understand these things. The only reason we think they're smart is because they have a lot of money. And that doesn't prove anything other than the fact that they have a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when you said the sociology, is that the whole idea of living in a cylinder? Because, you know, it sounds like a test tube experiment.
Yeah, living. Yeah, exactly. living in a cylinder, living in an underground colony on Mars. Like, it's just not going to work, right? Yeah. Like, these guys want to go to space to escape government regulation, but you cannot. You cannot escape politics. It's an inescapable feature of just having large numbers of humans living together. And they want to put large numbers of humans into space. There's going to be politics.
And you make there's an interesting segue there, which is how Silicon Valley's political attitudes have shifted in recent years.
Yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of people saying, oh, they shifted to the right. It's a betrayal of the true ethos of Silicon Valley. And I think it's less of a betrayal and more of like a reveal of what was always there. They have always been very interested in, you know, dominating authoritarian power. They've been very disdainful of government and democracy and, you know, the democratic process. They donated to political parties, and they donated to Democrats and to Republicans because, you know, that's what large businesses do. They donate to both parties so they can get the ear of government. And they claimed to have support for democracy until they felt like they could get away with saying, oh, yeah, actually, what we really care about is tech and not being regulated and being able to do whatever we want.
Yeah. Scary. So moving on, how often do you find that the pronouncements of tech ended? No?
I think we did that one.
Yeah, you think it's all there?
Let's. Okay. We should wrap. You end the book by posing the question, if not an immortal future in space, then what? What's the answer?
Yeah. No, it's a good question. And as I say in the book, sort of a question I was dreading. I think it's a hard question. But I think the good and hopeful answer is there's any number of things that we could do. You know, these billionaires talk about a future in space and a future with godlike AI as if it's inevitable. It's the only possible future. And the fact is there are many possible futures. But what I do think we should do is build a future that's not dominated by billionaires. And one way of doing that, as I say in the book, would be to tax them out of existence.
Is that feasible?
Yeah. Is that feasible? I mean, look, you know, there's all sorts of political realities that didn't look feasible until they were, right? Social Security was a pipe dream until it became real, right? Medicare and Medicaid were pipe dreams until they became real. Like the interstate highway system was a pipe dream until it became real. If there is the political will to say, okay, look, you know, there's a cap on how much money you can have. The most wealth that one person can accumulate is, say, $500 million. That's a lot of money still. We'd still have very wealthy people. But there's a difference between having enough money to, you know, do whatever you want for the rest of your life and having enough money to, you know, buy an entire government and try to take over the world. And I really think that it's risky for us as a society to, you know, allow billionaires to happen.
Yeah.
As I was reading the book, I was not expecting that to be the end. But it's a fascinating book. Adam Becker, More Everything Forever, AI Overlords, Space Empire, and Silicon Valley's Crusade to Control the Fate of Humanity. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we often discuss the stock exchange on this program, particularly on days like this when the Dow Jones is up 1,000 points. But we're normally talking about Wall Street and not Main Street in Camas. Today, we're joined by Guy Peterson. He is the proprietor of the Stock Exchange, a purveyor of meats and more in Camas. Good morning, Guy. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about your stock exchange. How long have you been in this business? And tell us a little bit about the career arc that drew you there.
Yeah, so we've been operating. This is a family-owned, operated facility that we've had for 2 years now. We take such pride in what we do. You know, as we live in such a crazy, fast society, it's, you know, we're able to slow that down a little bit. The joy of it is people come in, we bring friends and family together, and just kind of slow the pace down. So it's a great joy to have it.
So let's take it back a step. Tell us a little bit about you. How did you end up in this business?
Yeah, so I come from a family. We used to, you know, as a small child, we raised and owned our own cattle and sheep and whatnot. And also come from a family of extensive outdoor enthusiasts. So from a young age, going back from my grandfather, I learned the trade. I learned how to break down. I learned how to do all this processes. And as we moved into Camas, Utah, we saw there was a need for what we do. We strive to bring in high quality meats and seafoods that, you know, are desired. People are wanting it. So that's kind of what got me into it.
Yeah. And Where do you get the meats from?
So we get asked that question a lot. And there's not one particular place we get it because, again, going back to the quality of what we're trying to, you know, give to the public, we get a little bit of everything all over. So we're out seeking and searching the highest quality, whether it's beef, pork, chicken, seafood. We get it all over. But to answer your question more specifically, especially like with the beef, because that's probably our highest seller.
Yeah.
We do stay local to Utah. We also do support local farmers and ranchers in the actual Valley of Camas. So we do stock their products as well.
So how do you go about developing a relationship like that? I mean, it sounds as though you go out of your way to understand where your cows are coming from and how they get to there. Tell us about how you find and develop those relationships. And are there some particular suppliers on the beef side, for example, that you are particularly enthusiastic about?
Yeah, so, you know, to build those relationships locally, if we start there, it all breaks down to the actual animal. I mean, there's different ways that animals are raised and right. and cared for. Like the local ranches there in Camas, these are grass-fed, grass-finished, clean, wholesome animals that live a really good life.
Are they the ones we see off 248 as we're driving out there?
Yeah, you know, a lot of that beef could be right in our shop. And that's the idea is, you know, as we move into this cleaner act of eating and whatnot, you know, no hormones, no antibiotics in the food, no dyes, no nitrates. Those are the kind of things that we're after, and that's what we're searching when we're, you know, trying to build these relationships that you ask about.
Yeah. Now, how is it you stock different things than what I would see at the grocery store?
I think it goes back again to how you asked, how do we find that clean, clean air quotes, clean animal? That's the difference. You know, a lot of these animals could be raised, you know, wintered out in the deserts, let's say, all winter. They bring them into a feedlot, slaughter them, right? They haven't had the best nutrition. They have, you know, they could be loaded full of antibiotics and hormones, which we find in a lot of grocery stores today. And I'm not picking on all grocery stores because there are grocery stores that do, you know, go out and look and source and try to find the things that we have. I mean, you do have to pay a little bit more for that type of an animal, but that's kind of the difference is how they're raised. There's a commodity type market out there for the masses, if you will, and then there's a market for that clean, wholesome animal that we're looking to
and eat. So tell us a little more about the process. Okay, we've got a cow who's grazing out there in the fields. Where do you get involved? At what point do you get involved? Are you involved in the actual selection of the cuts and the butchering? Tell us how you come into this movie.
Yeah, so, I mean, really, you know, a majority of our beef, like I said, they live a clean, wholesome life. As far as the cuts and how we get involved, so the way we purvey our beef or our beef or whatever it may be, we don't break down a whole animal like a processing plant. So all of our products, you know, they come from certified processing to where they are broken down into what we call primals. So you think of like a prime rib, a big old chunk of meat. We're buying primals, what they call in the industry primals, and then we're breaking it down in our shop from there and doing the cuts of steak. So, I mean, you have your popular cuts like ribeye, New York's, filet mignon. Those are the primals, the big roast forms that we're taking, cleaning them up and preparing them for a nice presentation.
So, gotcha.
And how we select that is just what people are requesting. So,
yeah. Now let's move into seafood.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of seafood do you have? I mean, do you have, I assume it's seasonal.
Yeah, a lot of it is seasoned. So, currently, and the way we operate is, again, you know, we're a small shop in Camas, Utah, so we have our staples. We have salmon, different varieties of salmon, scallops, tuna, which those three that I mentioned are all sushi grade within our shop. So if you wanted to go home and prepare your own poke bowls or sashimi, so be it with those cuts. This time of year, halibut's really popular. It's in season. We sell a tremendous amount of halibut, and then we also have open ears to the public. If there's something that somebody wants that we might not have in, we love bringing in featured fish of the week. Upon request, people can call in and say, hey, I would like fish, you know, whether it be a Chilean sea bass to swordfish or live mussels for that, you know, live oysters. We'll bring those in for you.
And again, how tricky is that supply chain? How do you develop those relationships?
Yeah, so again, it goes back again. We buy from different purveyors depending on the quality of what we're looking for. Like for instance, like our Norwegian salmon, when I get it in my shop, it was literally swimming 2 days ago. That's how, you know, so we got to pick and choose where we're getting what from, depending on what day they're getting it in, so that we can make sure that we are providing the freshest possible fish to the customer.
Now, do you provide any seafood for sushi restaurants around town?
We do not do like our own purveying per se, but what we do, we are partnering with local sushi chefs, and we do a takeout sushi program on Friday nights. We started at 4 o'clock and end at 6 o'clock. The community know there's great eateries in the Camas Valley, but it's just something different on that Friday night weekend thing where people can come in and get, you know, a nice roll of sushi. Or
so you have takeout sushi on Friday. Do you also have crab cakes typically on Fridays?
Well, you know, we do. It depends on the workflow and what's going on, but we do make a house-made crab cake that seems to fly off the shelf, and when we don't have it...
We hear about it,
yeah. And you know, we try to always make sure that we have those, but again, it's depending on workload and how the week is, and... But yeah, there's a wide variety of seafoods that you can get down to the Stock Exchange.
Yeah, right now is definitely Maryland crab season.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Do you get some Maryland crab in and make crab cakes out of that?
Let me tell you a little story about that.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't want to get into, you know, too drawn out, but that's a very tough product to get.
Yeah.
Very, very tough. The big, like the Costco's of the world, they'll pre-buy almost all of that stuff, you know. So it gets hard to get that kind of stuff. But most everything else we can pretty much get in.
Poultry,
yes. Free-range chickens. Again, going back to the shop, no hormones, no added antibiotics in the product. We do sell a tremendous amount of chicken.
Do you get ducks as well?
We do, yeah. We have duck breasts, and we have whole ducks that we serve. One thing that we have that we hear a lot of compliments on is veal. They say that veal is very hard to find anywhere. So a lot of our customers come in and thank us for the fact that we have nice quality selects of veal.
So you have veal, you also have lamb chops or other lamb products.
Lamb products, a wide variety of lamb products. We carry obviously pork. We're looking to introduce here in the next couple weeks bison. So we're going to have... Good. Bison ribeyes, New York's, filet mignon. That's coming up here very soon.
Yeah, I know. Now, the duck that you have, you don't have to fish out the BBs, right?
Oh, no BBs. No BBs, no.
I've had that a few times.
Yeah, no, these are clean-raised. Again, very, very healthy farms that these are raised on. High-quality ducks that you see served in most high-end restaurants around in the Park City area.
Now, are all your products thawed, or do you sell any frozen products?
No, we do sell frozen products, like duck, for instance, that we were just speaking about. And a lot of our products as well that we do sell fresh, like let's just use chicken, for instance. We'll sell fresh chicken, meaning fresh, meaning thawed.
Right.
And then we have that same chicken in a vacuum-sealed package in our freezer because we get a lot of shoppers that come to the Camas Valley from Park City, Heber. They want to stock up their freezers, you know, so they'll want to buy it vacuum-sealed to where they can just stock up and have supply on hand.
As opposed to just sticking to the freezer where it gets all icy. And
exactly, yeah.
Custom products. Does the fact that you are doing some of that work within the shop enable you to do things like create roasts or other kinds of things, particularly for special occasions like an Easter or another holiday?
Yeah, so Christmas time is a great example. We do a tremendous amount of filet mignon roasts that we hand tie in the shop, prime ribs. And it doesn't have to be just a holiday. We do them like this last weekend for Mother's Day, we did, you know, quite a few filet mignon roasts. They call it the ladies cut. So obviously it was a popular cut. But yeah, if you want a special cut, we're happy to get it done for you.
What about carpaccio?
Carpaccio. I can't say that I've brought that in, but we can do it.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about a filet mignon roast. Is that a less fatty roast?
Yeah, filet mignon is a very tender, less fatty, very lean cut of meat. And then you can get into, you know, your prime ribs that are on the other spectrum. That's a very marbled, you know, fattier, if you will, cut of meat. But yeah, that's kind of why they call it the ladies' cut, because one, it's easy to chew, and two, it's not very fatty. It's a nice lean piece of meat.
And you cut it with a butter knife, I'm sure.
Yeah, people say they can literally cut our filet mignons with a fork. I hear it all the time.
Okay, so if our listeners want to find you, where are you?
So we're located on 150 South Main Street in Camas, Utah, and you can find us. We're just south of the major intersection where 7-Eleven crosses there. Mm-hmm. We're in the Big Red Building, kind of hard to find, the Big Red Building right on 150 South Main.
And do you have a website?
You know, we're actually working on that. As we moved into our new location, we were in a small, intimate space prior. We were afraid to grow too fast.
Yeah.
And we're finding this growth. As the community grows, we're growing with it. So we're working on that now that we're into our new location. But you can find us on Facebook and Instagram until that's...
Now, the new location's, I take it, bigger than the old one. I got to walk in there on last week, and it's big and airy. Are you going to have, like, sit-down spaces for people to... I saw some stools by the counter. Are you looking forward to having some places where people could stop and eat a sandwich or something like that in the future?
Yeah, it's not in the immediate plans, mm-hmm. but it's in, you know, the long-term forecasted plans. Again, what we want to do is grow responsibly with the community. So it's coming. Hopefully, we're going to be working on that because we have a lot of requests for that.
Now, can people call you? And do you have a phone number that we can share with everyone?
We do. I don't have it off the top of my head. I never call myself. 435-783-5626. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty confident that's what
it is.
And
they can special order things. I mean, let's say it's a NASCAR race coming up. Can I order a pig for a pig pick?
Yes, that's a great question, and I appreciate you asking, because especially as we talked about seafood. So seafood is one of those things that we try to pretty much run out of because we get it fresh Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. So if you're having a big event or, you know, a get-together, it's good to call in and pre-order because we'll pull that in for you, allocate it for you, and make sure that we have it and you don't have to have any ruined dinner plans. So, yeah, we really appreciate call-ins because it helps us manage our time.
Okay, Guy Peterson of the Stock Exchange. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having us on.
We began this program by a discussion about AI and AGI and lots of concepts. We hear about AI being used in different ways, writing essays, self-driving cars, but home building? Seriously? To answer that question, we're joined by Claude Bethea of Solux Homes. Good morning, Claude. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Hey, glad to be here.
So I understand you have a tech background and that you're presently building your own home. Where did this idea of using AI in home building come from?
Well, I really felt like the process, if you've ever been through the process of building your own home, just getting started, just getting to the point where you're putting a shovel in the ground is pretty difficult. You mm-hmm. have a lot of decisions to make. And most people are very visual. They have a hard time really, you know, seeing it for themselves. But when you can put something in front of somebody, when you can use technology to bring them into a vision, whether it's, you know, a two-dimensional drawing, you know, or a three-dimensional tour in a virtual reality setting, all of a sudden that whole world, that process from getting to point A to point B is shrunk 90%.
Yeah, I imagine there's a lot of builders in town who will say that, you know, they finish a two-year build and someone comes along, yeah, I thought the fireplace would be over there.
A lot of people have difficulty seeing that final vision.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we've tried to do, and I've always been in the tech space, and I just felt like this industry, the construction industry as a whole, has really been left behind in terms of how are they integrating technology into their business. And, you know, they're not doing it very successfully.
It does seem like the building of a home today is not all that different in terms of the nuts and bolts, and more accurately, screws and nails, than it was 30 years ago, 40 years ago.
It hasn't changed, and a big reason is that because the trades have not changed. So what do you always do? You're comfortable doing the things that you're comfortable doing.
Mm-hmm.
And learning something new is difficult. That's why you haven't really seen, I know we've all heard about, like, the cement-printed house. You know, 3D printed houses. And you're like, well, where are these 3D printed houses? You know, why aren't they here? Well, it's because you're kind of taking an industry that is traditionally sticks and bricks and turning it into something that's tech driven. And it's, you know, they're like, oh, I don't have a trade that can do that.
Yeah.
I have a framer. right, you know, right. And an electrician.
He can nail 2x4s.
Yeah.
Now, is the AI just in the design phase, or is it throughout the entire, you know, from soup to nuts?
Currently, it's mostly in the design and in the permitting and the project management phases. There's not really a lot of AI in the actual construction component of it just yet. Now, as a technologist and somebody who kind of looks at technology and says, hey, what is this going to look like in 5 or 10 years? Well, if Elon Musk has his way and we have these robots, okay, now all of a sudden you're going to have, you know, the integration of AI, that AI engine that's driving those robots to actually do a tradesman's job, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah. Exciting, scary, strange,
yeah.
All those things. So let's sort of take it back. You're talking about at the design phase. Historically, I had an architect who would have these blue pencils and would draw these diagrams. And I would look at that, and I'm very poor at visualizing. So when my wife and I were building a house years ago, I would look at the thing and I'd go, I have no idea what that's going to really look like. Talk to us about how you're using intelligence to bring that, you know, two-dimensional sketch to life.
Well, AI is not really doing the bringing a two-dimension into a three-dimension. Now, AR and VR, alternate reality and virtual reality, are huge tools in doing that particular thing, which is the first part of how we are bringing that technology to our customers. Mm-hmm. Because I would like the customer to be able to go into VR and design their home, place furniture, sit in their furniture, and feel like, okay, this is exactly what it's going to look like, because then they can see it. But as far as the AI component, I can go in there and a client could say, Claude, I like mid-century modern with emphasis on it and with a little industrial. And I can go to my AI, you know, models, and I can say, I need a three-bedroom, 4,500-square-foot house that is based on mid-century modern with a little bit of industrial. And it will generate some basically pictures, two-dimensional pictures, concept drawings of what that would look like. Also floor plans. Mm-hmm. So because it can scour like all of the floor plans and all of those design prompts that you're giving it and then provide you, you know, with some samples. Now that part gets the customer, no, instead of having to go off and draw that,
yeah,
and paying all that money, I can generate that in, what, a minute, mm-hmm, 2 minutes, and then give that to the client and say, is this what you're looking for? Something like this?
And then the site plan, you can lay that onto the site plan, and then they can move it, say, oh, I want a view of that peak from the master bedroom.
Oh, most definitely, when I put people in VR,
yeah,
I can put them where they can look through every window in the direction that they want to be. So, you know, I could have them walk out on a balcony. I have a video of when we rendered our home,
yeah,
that we're building right now, and you can walk to the balcony and you can see exactly where each peak is going to be. Pretty impressive.
Very impressive. Now, my favorite parts of home building, budgeting and permitting.
Mm-hmm. That's everybody's favorite,
yeah,
right?
We, yeah, just love it. So I imagine AI cranks out the budget and then can make, how does that, can you explain how that works?
So right now, you know, permitting is a pretty arduous process. Now that's why,
no,
when you come, look, you come to Park City, hey, you're gonna find some, you have reputable architects here. They know the code in the permitting process here. So, you know, they are the ones who are being the AI, right? And they're staying within those guidelines. But wouldn't it really be nice if I can upload my plans and have AI look at any jurisdiction's permitting codes and then apply those jurisdictions and those codes against, mm-hmm, the plan that's been submitted and then tell you where the problems are? And that's what AI is good at. It's good at doing that tedious work of making sure, you know, the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed.
Yeah, I imagine that would also help if people want a specific floor plan, an exact house, and say, really love this house, and they have enough money to do it, but I want that same house here in the mountains of Park City and then up on the coast of Maine. And
yeah,
then
what does that mean? What does it mean for each one of those different locales?
Yeah, for sure.
Do you expect to see this technology being adopted on the other side of that transaction?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, that's where I, as a builder, that's where I hope it's adapted to, is to the actual permitting office and the planning office, because they're the ones who, at the end of the day, have to say yes or no. And if I can get, if I can take 90% of the tedium out of their job, then they can spend more time servicing, you know, the builders and the people that are trying to get things passed.
Yeah, not just sit in the office looking at the plans, getting out on the site and going, are you following that to the T?
Yeah, and I will say this, most of the, we have good inspectors.
Absolutely.
In these areas, you know, I work in Wasatch and in Summit, and that's, you know, we have really good inspectors. I have to really give the inspectors props because they do a great job on site and they do catch things.
Mm-hmm.
No, you know, it's a custom home, generally custom homes. They're more expensive because nobody's ever built that home.
Right.
And you don't know where the problems are going to be. And it's very difficult to see where the problems are going to come up in a two-dimensional drawing.
Yeah.
Even if you have it in three dimensions, you can spin that model around. And I don't think that I've ever had a set of plans that were perfect. Now, I'm hoping that AI and these tools that as they trickle down into, you know my profession, that will become smaller and smaller and smaller, you know. So maybe we have 10 problems now, maybe there'll be three or one, you know,
or none. And maybe if they're using the same AI software, it will pinpoint, you know, you try to make it fail.
Yeah.
How can I fail this plan?
Yep.
Just to see, okay, it's passing.
So Claude, I'm listening to this conversation, chatting with you, and thinking about what you do. Where, and historically, there was a division between the architect over here, the plans would come, I'd hire an architect, I'd get a drawing.
Yeah.
After I got the drawing, I'd go find myself a builder, and the builder would look at that. It sounds to me like you're somewhere in a different spectrum. Can you help us understand that?
Yeah, we really try to get to the buyer first.
Okay.
And the reason is because I can help you in a lot of areas before you get to the architect. I can help you with site selection, which is a really big deal. Because site selection could be the difference between, like, I'll give you an example. There may be a piece of property that's $200,000 and another piece of property that's $300,000. And the customer says, well, I don't want to spend $300,000, I want to spend $200,000. But I can look at that piece of property and I can say yes, but the problem is it's going to cost you another $200,000 to build on that $200,000. The $300,000 property will save you $100,000.
Yeah.
So if the builder can get, you know, somebody that understands what they're looking at, even, and I think that there's quite a few architects that can help you with this, but the builders are really more qualified because they're the ones that are working hands-on with the excavation component of it. So if I can get there first, then I can really help.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to move on to the subcontractors that are doing the work. I understand that your AI can help with job safety and virtual training for the subcontractor, so instead of on-the-job training of someone who knows nothing, they can do it virtually?
Yeah, you know, that's where AR and VR have played a big role in technology and in training in general, right? Is I can submerge somebody into an environment and have them test in something that's, you know, more true to life than just kind of a written test, kind of regurgitating information. We can put them in the environment, you know, and have them actually test out.
Yeah, I imagine that would be very helpful. They do it with pilots.
They do it
with simulators and such.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much easier to simulate an environment in today's technology than it used to be. So, yeah, there are definitely purpose-built technologies. I know that all the safety councils that are generally supporting industry are heavily invested in VR and that type of testing. Certainly AI can help generate the testing materials because it can take best practices and it can take, you know, all of the code and it can automatically generate tests for you. I don't know if you guys use AI at all, but I mean, it's unbelievable what it can do in a matter of minutes.
I thought I used AI until Adam Becker told me that ChatGPT wasn't really AI. That was our author early on. Now, if I owned a roofing company, I could train my employees or find out if my employees are afraid of heights just through the simulator, probably. Because who wants to put them up on a three-story roof and have them
But I would hope that if you're in, if you're signing up to be a roofer, that well, you've already figured that out.
So Claude, we're getting near the end here. I want to give you a chance to tell our listeners just a little bit more about your business, the range of what you do, the kind of homes you build.
So we're definitely primarily a custom home builder, and the range is generally from, I would say, 2.5 to 3 million to 20 million is kind of the range of the homes that we build. And, I think what makes us different is we are bringing technology, that technology component, into the pre-process and the pre-planning of building a home. You know, our whole goal is to get to that homeowner first. We're working with realtors actually right now, because generally the realtor is the first step in the transaction. They're going to go look for property. So we're trying to educate all the realtors out there. Hey, I'll go walk that property with you and the homeowner.
Yeah.
You know, and are the five properties that homeowner is looking at, and then talk to that homeowner for a little bit to make sure that, you know, we can execute their vision on that piece of property. And then again, just the personal nature of what we do. Our goal is to be friends, long-term friends with our clients.
How many homes do you typically want to build at the same time?
We can build up to 10, but typically we'd like to build 3 to 5. Mm-hmm. We really want, you know, we're not trying to be a huge company. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to do really, really fantastic work for a few, you know, a handful of people a year.
Website?
Website is soluxhome.com.
And is there a gallery of some of your existing projects on there?
There's a lot of information on there that you can find.
And before we go, so this is a business and finance show. Does it make the home build more expensive or less expensive?
I think it's less expensive in the long run, because you're not making the same mistakes.
Yeah.
The more you can plan a home, the lower the cost is.
Yeah, exactly.
And the quicker you can get it built, which is if you're borrowing money, that's a big deal.
Well, that was Claude Bethay with Solux Homes. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And we'd also like to thank our other guests, Guy Peterson over at Stock Exchange, and Adam Becker with his fantastic book, More Everything Forever.
Our theme music, ROI, was written by Parker Swenson, and it's performed by Swenson, David Becker, and Tony Ellison. Please subscribe to the Mountain Money Podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.